This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hurricane Maria devastated the island of Puerto Rico, and some central Illinois Puerto Rican natives with relatives there say the U.S. response so far to the unprecedented crisis has been far from adequate.
The lack of empathy coming from the highest levels of political office in this country is really an insult.
GLT's Judy Valente talks with ISU professor Maura Toramorin and Illinois Wesleyan professor Denali Flores Rodriguez about what they're hearing from stranded family members. The community's bike share program is at the six-month point. Find out from Town of Normal officials where it might be headed. And you'll hear from ISU head basketball coach Dan Muller about the indictment of four NCAA assistant coaches from other schools on fraud and corruption charges. All of that and a GLT News update on the way. It's September 28th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Hurricane Maria devastated most of the infrastructure of the island of Puerto Rico, leaving residents scrambling for food, water, gasoline, and other necessities. Because communication lines were destroyed, information is only slowly trickling out from the U.S. island territory, and the news is not good. Maura Toramorin is a Puerto Rican native and sociology professor at Illinois State University. Danila Flores Rodriguez is a professor of Hispanic Studies at Illinois Wesleyan University and was also born on the island. Both are in touch with relatives. Maura Toramorin tells GLT's Judy Valente that the U.S. government response to the crisis affecting Puerto Rico's 3.4 million residents has been far from adequate.
My concern initially was with my family. I am from the west side of the island, a town that is a coastal town. And I wanted to know about my brother, about my sisters, about my family. And we were completely incommunicado for at least 4 days after the hurricane. Some information and some pictures began to filter out.
Have you heard from your family directly since then?
2 days ago, I did. I heard from my brother. My brother is a police, is a municipal police, and he was able to communicate with me because the mayor of Cabo Rojo, the mayor of my hometown, traveled to San Juan to request aid and to talk to some of the political officials and to do some of the business that he had to do in San Juan to secure help for the town of Cabo Rojo. And from San Juan was the first city that got cellular service. And he finally was able to talk to me and convey to me in the most sort of heartfelt language the devastation that he had seen.
What specifically did he say?
It was like complete devastation. First of all of the rivers near my hometown overflowed. The town of Cabo Rojo was completely overflown, something that we had not seen in nearly 80 years in Puerto Rico. Communities completely devastated, completely wiped out. Roads that were impassable because of trees and electricity poles and cables down. No water, no electricity, complete darkness. You could tell that his voice was trembling when he was speaking to me on the phone.
Professor Denali Flores Rodriguez, who is here with us, a professor at Illinois Wesleyan, do you have family over there, and what is it that you've heard?
All of my family is actually there. I've heard from several members, but still many of my family members are unaccounted for. My immediate family, my sister, her family, and my mother spent the hurricane together in Guaynabo, which is next to the metropolitan area, and their house is on concrete. We have very strict building codes in Puerto Rico, so they didn't suffer it as much as other people. Now, most of my family is from the north and the west side of the island. I have family in Arecibo, which is where the Hurricane Eye left the island. I have family who lost everything, cars, everything. And this is not only limited to family members, but friends as well. there are other people in the west side of the island which I haven't heard from.
What about access to food and drinking water for your family members? How's that coming along?
I actually got a call yesterday from one cousin who is on Arecibo on the north side of the island. He is desperate. He has his wife is pregnant. She's about to give birth. And they're scared. There's no water. There's no running water. They have to economize gas as much as they can because, of course, her wife could go into labor at any moment. They're scared because they are afraid of being assaulted. People are desperate right now. This is a humanitarian crisis, so people have no food and no water, and there being a lot of assaults in as a result of that.
So. Is there anything that your family here in the States can do for them? And I'll pose that to both of you. Professor Flores Rodriguez first, please.
Not much right now. The communications and postal service is very constrained, very limited. Not all of the towns have access to roads. Many of the towns, I think, Omakau and certain parts of the west side of the island can only be accessed through helicopters. And there is no airport that it's working right now.
So you can't even send a care package or money or anything.
The aid is very slowly arriving there. It started today, but it's still a very limited effort.
Therein lies really the complexity of the situation. A significant portion of Puerto Ricanos that live here in the United States, and unless you have access to an airplane, or unless you have access to, you know, ways of getting materials to people in the island, our hands are pretty much sort of tied in terms of what we could do. The one thing that we could do is that we could raise awareness about the situation in Puerto Rico, and we could help. As bizarre as this may sound, this is really a teachable moment for Americans to understand the sort of the historical legacy of U.S. involvement in the Caribbean and in Latin America.
What is it that Americans need to learn about that?
Well, first, they need to understand that Puerto Rico is part of the United States. They need to understand that Puerto Ricans are U.S. citizens. And they need to understand that Puerto Rico is undergoing an economic situation right now. After the recession, the island is nearly bankrupt. So, you know, this our ability to be able to ask for a loan to build the infrastructure is seriously compromised under the current political situation.
Well, I want to ask both of you about the response of the U.S. government to Puerto Rico. Have you been satisfied with the response, and what do you think could be done differently? Go ahead, Professor Flores.
I would say that the aid has been very slowly. We have in the island 3.4 million U.S. citizens, and that is just in the island of Puerto Rico. We are not counting the U.S. Virgin Islands. Right now, it's just the media is paying a little bit more of attention, and it's 1 week later. After this happened, my husband is in the National Guard. He was deployed for Irma even before it crossed Florida. And now
Hurricane Irma in Florida.
And now he just got called today. He just got deployed today, a week later.
So it sounds like what you're saying is there's a double standard here.
Oh, it is.
Professor Flores Rodriguez sort of has articulated some of the complexity of this. Irma had already skirted the island. My sister, for example, in Cabo Rojo, had been without electricity for a week before it had been restored. And so a lot of the resources that had been needed to replace electricity in the aftermath of Irma had already been used for that. And now there are no cables. There are no resources to be able to restore electricity again. So what happens is that we had FEMA, first responders in Puerto Rico at the time. And in fact, there are first responders there now. The problem is that how do you reach some of the most remote parts of the island when there are no roads? And so first the roads had to be reconstructed. And for that, you need machinery. For that, you need people with the expertise to be able to remove the trees. And then the first responders can come and address that. There is one more point that needs to be articulated. And that is that is that the lack of empathy coming from the highest levels of political office in this country, namely our beloved president. When you hear him tweeting about Puerto Rico being already in bad shape and referencing to Wall Street that they will get their money's worth, it's really an insult.
I want to hear you on that, Professor Flores Rodriguez. What was your reaction to those comments?
I think that the response has been very slow. It is complicated, as Professor Maura Toro Warren said, by our political situation. We cannot receive foreign aid, even though foreign aid could be closer to where we are right now. We cannot receive foreign aid because the Congress needs to authorize it. And if foreign ships with foreign aid get to arrive to Puerto Rico, they're going to have to pay punitive taxes and tariffs in order to help us.
Although that rule about foreign ships coming to American shores was relaxed for the people in Texas.
Yes, it was relaxed for people in Texas and Florida.
Both of you teach. I want to talk to you about what your students are saying. Do you have any students who are from Puerto Rico or have family in Puerto Rico?
Yes, I do. But this is something that should compete to every American citizen, not only Puerto Ricans, because this is a precedent. This is creating a precedent for how American citizens overall are being treated in the United States by their government, not paying attention to 3.4 million people in Puerto Rico means that this could also happen here.
Thank you
every
so much.
American
you.
Citizen
so we're doing
should
it.
Pay attention
yes.
to how the government are taking care of it. Now, for my students, going back to your question, I have made them very aware of what's happening. Even some of those, some of my students were not aware. They're young. They don't tend to hear as much news as we would want to. But I have made them very aware. I'm actually trying to collect emergency supplies in my institution, and they already approached me and said, I am sorry, Professor, I'm going to try to help. I asked them to call their representatives to exert pressure into Congress and the government so we can get the help we need and we deserve.
Do you know if those students have relatives over there, though?
I'm sure they have. I also know of employees in my institution who haven't been able at this day to reach to their parents, the elderly parents and family members. So this is still something that it's going on.
Well, final question for both of you. If you were able to get the president's ear, President Trump's ear, and the ear of Congress, what would you say? What do you want to see happen to help Puerto Rico? Professor Flores Rodriguez?
What we would ask is for the President of the United States to reconsider his position on allowing for foreign ships
to bring in aid.
To bring in aid into the island. I would also ask him to consider health care parity in all federal programs, because Puerto Ricans have a long history of not having health care repairs. So everything is more expensive for us. And right now, we don't have the economic means. We are trying to rebuild a whole country. Those two things and a quicker response. And I know that the military is already working on it, and FEMA and several federal institutions are working towards bringing us help. But I think that those two elements are of imperative necessity right now.
Professor Toro Morn.
Aid is very important. Material, economic aid is very important, but also a sense of empathy. And a sense that you care about the island of Puerto Rico and its American citizens. I think that when you create an atmosphere where you racialize and you humiliate Americans, it really sends a message to the rest of Americans that we should not care. And indeed, this is a crisis like we have not seen in the island of Puerto Rico. And the repercussions of this crisis have yet to be felt. Aftermath of the economic recession of 2008, we began to see massive movements, migrations to the United States, making Florida, for example, now the state with the fastest and and largest growing Puerto Rican population, imagine what this is going to do in the context of sort of the Puerto Rican communities that are already here and the desire for Puerto Ricanos to really reconstitute their families and reconstitute their lives the way they had before the hurricane. I think the hurricane has really revealed 100 years of U.S. colonization that is really you're beginning to see the collapse of sort of the infrastructure, the lack of attention, and the political limbo that exists right now in the island. So I would say aid is very important. Empathy is even more important. And of course, reconsideration of the debt, because that's really sort of part of the economic crisis of Puerto Rico. What are we going to do with that debt? Relieve that debt in order for Puerto Rico to be able to build the infrastructure.
Professor Mauro Toro-Morn is of the Sociology Department at ISU, and Professor Denali Flores Rodriguez is a professor of Hispanic Studies at Illinois Wesleyan. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Judy Valente.
The White House earlier today authorized a waiver to loosen shipping rules regarding Puerto Rico. Island officials say the waiver will help in the recovery. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from The Music Shop, helping student musicians of all skill levels sound their best by partnering with school band and orchestra programs throughout Central Illinois. Instrument rentals, sales, maintenance, and repair. Details at themusicshop.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Usage of the community's bike share program is continuing to grow 6 months after its launch. On March 20th, white bikes with white baskets started zipping across Bloomington Normal. The town of Normal rolled out Bike Share 309. The contract with Zagster is for 47 bikes and 9 stations in mostly Normal, but also on the ISU and IWU campuses and at the McLean County Museum of History. In the studio to talk about Bike Share 309 at the six-month point is Town of Normal Planner and the town's unofficial bike policy coordinator, Mercy Davis. And Mercy, thanks for your time on Sound Ideas.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike.
How close are you coming to where you wanted to be or where you thought you might be in terms of usage at the six-month point?
Well, we're maybe a hair behind, but this is all based on target numbers that were set by the company based on similar communities. We'd like to live up to those numbers, and we think we're probably going to get there by the end of the year. I wasn't sure where we'd be, though, at the end of September. It's just so darn beautiful outside right now.
And you have, you know, 2 more months of great riding weather, maybe even into November.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As someone who rides a bike a lot myself, and I'm not particularly hardy, I regularly ride through Thanksgiving.
So started off kind of wet and cold, though.
Oh my gosh. It was such a drag. Oh, my gosh.
So more than 2,600 trips in 6 months and 882 members. What did Zagster say you should be around?
So they're saying by the end of this calendar year, we should be shooting for 3,300 trips. And as of just before this interview, we're close to 2,700 trips. So we need about, oh, can I do the math that fast? Like 600 more rides?
in 2 or 3 months, you should be able.
That should be doable. That's doable to me.
And what about the number of members? 882 members at this point.
Right. Well, it's 893 now, Mike. You need
numbers,
the update.
The numbers keep moving quickly.
Right, right. And that's the number of users, people who've downloaded the app and ridden. So we're close to 900 right now. They were hoping we'd be at 1,800.
You're about halfway.
We are. But the interesting thing is that we have lower users, but the correct number of rides, which just means that fewer people are riding an awful darn lot, which is great.
The town is paying almost $87,000 a year for 3 years to Zagster to provide this community service. You're expecting to recoup some of that cost from user fees. Where are you on that?
We don't have as many annual members as we'd like, and that's where the bigger chunk of money could come from a user. If somebody just gets on, you know, downloads the app, rides a bike for an hour, and pays the hourly fee, that's $3. If we can get somebody to buy an annual membership, it's either $25 or $40. So clearly, that would bring in more money. Overall, though, it's still not going to come anywhere near the total cost of the program.
Sure. So we're at the six-month point. Let's say you double those 2,600 trips over 12 months. That's 5,200 trips. The town's investment per ride is more than $16. Is that a reasonable subsidy?
Yeah, we think it is. I mean, you have to look at it beyond just that very simple math equation that you laid out. I mean, that's a valid place to start, and I think that's great. But you have to think about the overall economic impact of what people riding those bikes are also spending their money on. We know that people who are using bikes to get around on a trail, people who have come here to visit and ride a bike, those people are spending money doing other things. So it's very similar to other types of programs that government subsidizes. It's also very important to us to bring bicycle availability into our transportation system. I mean, this is a system-wide transportation initiative. Granted, we're starting in a fairly small geographic area, but we plan to spread out from there.
So you don't really know the full economic impact of what this program might be bringing to the community.
Oh, that is true. We do not know that. And keep in mind, the cost the town is paying was also offset by a donation from Advocate Bromen, so that number comes down a little bit, and then the user fees. But again, you're never going to get a math equation that looks like an amazing dollar amount per ride.
But you might expect that $16 per ride to decrease over the three-year life.
Absolutely.
At least the first three-year investment of the town into this program.
Absolutely.
Zagster provides the bikes, the technology, the app, the kiosks around the community, and pays someone locally to maintain the bikes and rebalance the bikes, or making sure the bikes are in good working order and making sure there aren't empty kiosks. Are you satisfied with the maintenance end and the rebalancing at this point?
Yeah, it's been going really well lately. It's been very interesting to see the difference between summer and the start of the school year. So, of course, over the summer, the stations at ISU were not used terribly often, especially Tri-Towers and Cardinal Court. Now, of course, the reverse is true. Tri-Towers is so busy, and we routinely see bikes coming from Tri-Towers ending up at Schrader, which is just what we assumed would happen because that's such a popular destination for classes. That's, you know. Interestingly, Cardinal Court isn't getting used as much as we thought, and we think that's because they have such great bus service there that loads of people that live out there just get on the bus all the time. So it'll be interesting to see how we might boost those numbers over time.
These are basically regular cruiser bikes. They're not the heavy or heavy-duty bikes you might see used in larger metropolitan bike share programs. Are they holding up okay at the six-month point?
Yeah, they really are. The mechanic goes by once a week at least and checks every single bike. And so that really helps keep them in good repair, air in the tires, making sure the brakes are adjusted, et cetera. So we can avoid a lot of problems by just keeping up on the maintenance.
Sure. And that's, if you have a crummy bike or a bike that doesn't shift well or doesn't stop well, that certainly affects the customer experience and their willingness to come back and use it again.
Absolutely.
What's your impression of Zagster so far? A good partner?
Yeah, they've been a good partner. As far as I understand, they're expanding just exponentially across the country. So I think they're having some growing pains. It's a lot of different cities and communities to manage, but I think they're doing a pretty good job of it. It will be interesting to see where they're at as a company 2 or 3 years from now. I really have no idea.
I mean, they've picked a niche community, right? A certain size.
Right. They seem to be aiming for communities of our size or large corporate or university campuses, which kind of function as about the same size as normal. So yeah, this seems to be their niche.
What about their commitment to customer service and customer experience?
You know, they answer all the calls 24/7 from riders who are having issues, and I myself have used that line, and it is very smooth. They have great answers. They put the bike into the system. I mean, through the, you know, their technology with the mechanic, they let the mechanic know what's going on. So it's been really a good experience that way.
What was your call about?
I was at one of the stations and I just noticed that one of the bikes had the headlight was a little bit dangly and it just needed to be tightened up.
So, and that got to the mechanic and the mechanic fixed it.
Yeah.
So what sort of things, if any, are you hearing from customers?
I know of people who ride every day because they just don't own their own bike and their kid got them a membership. And so to them, riding a bike is just really fun. It's a great way to get exercise. And those people are just effusive. Like, they're so happy about it. They're so grateful. I see a lot of people out who are with, like, what appears to be a friend who has their own bike. And so it's like one friend with a bike takes another friend out and they can now get a bike and go for a ride together, which is fantastic to see. I've had people call me who are coming to visit our community and say, hey, is that bike share program still around? How do I use it? So I'm getting a lot of really good feedback.
Maybe I wasn't entirely accurate here. I said 47 bikes. It's actually 45 bikes and two trikes, two adult tricycles.
It's true.
Are they getting any use? And what are you hearing about those?
You know, it's funny, the one track in particular that's in Uptown, that's the one that gets used every single day by the same person who I know. I only know her through this program. But the other one is typically an advocate, thinking that they're the population of people at Advocate, whether visitors, not really patients, I guess. There might be more people who would skew towards a tricycle level of comfort, but I don't actually think it's getting a ton of use. And so that's something we'll keep an eye on. We could always switch it out with a different kind of bike. Zagster offers like 8 different kinds of bikes. You can even get like a side-by-side bike.
Tandem.
Someone who's like vision impaired could ride with a sighted individual. Bada bing, bada boom. Pretty awesome.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy in with Mercy Davison with the Town of Normal to talk about Bike Share 309. The program is just past the 6-month point. I see people using the service that seem to be out for a nice recreational ride. I also see people, you know, with messenger bags or items in the basket that seem to be riding with purpose. They're going somewhere. Do you have any way to know the breakdown of recreational versus transportation-oriented riders? And does the town even care?
It would certainly be great to know. Right now, we have no real way to track that. I don't know if Zagster itself could do some sort of surveying through the app itself. They have a lot of ways to reach out to customers directly. But yeah, I mean, anecdotally, just seeing people, most people appear to be recreational. But the other day I was driving on Parkway Plaza near Portillo's, and I saw a guy on a Bike Share 309 coming across Veterans with the light, following the instructions, following the law. And he had a half gallon of orange juice in the basket and other groceries. And he looked to be about college age. And I thought, that's kind of awesome.
So he took a trip to,
to get groceries.
A grocery store in that area and got groceries and is riding back. Great. So you mentioned this, you alluded to it, characterize this service as a transportation and mobility service for the community or part of that piece of that piece of the puzzle for mobility in the community.
Yeah, well, I mean,
how does it fit?
That's definitely a goal of the program. I mean, we just know that more and more people are trying to get around communities all across the country without having to own their own car. Or maybe they're in a family where there's one car instead of two or three. And so by putting these bikes out in key destinations, we're trying to make it easier for people to make that decision that maybe we don't need that second or third car. When I get to my job at ISU, if I need something, I can hop on a bike share bike, do my business, come back. It's great. The reality is, just based on, again, anecdotal observations, is that there's a lot of recreational riding going on, which is also really helpful for other things like keeping people off the streets for as far as traffic congestion goes, promoting health and wellness. It's good for cutting down pollution. So you kind of can't lose with people on bikes. But the transportation piece I see evolving more over time.
You mentioned the kiosks after school started at Tri-Towers and at Schrader. Where are the most popular kiosks or stations to check out and return bikes? And are they the same? In other words, is the kiosk where the most checkouts are, is that the same one as the one where they get the most returns?
It does tend to work out that way. I think there's a lot of out and back riding where mm-hmm. someone will start at one station and end at the same station.
But the beauty of a bike share program is you don't have to do that.
You don't have to. You really don't. Or like in the case of people coming from Tri-Towers, going to class at Schrader, they might get on a different bike at that same station and ride it back to Tri-Towers at the end of the day. So so that certainly is happening all the time.
But most popular kiosks? Then?
Oh, the one in Uptown station, or the one in Uptown is the most heavily used, followed by Watterson.
And that's at the corner. The one in Uptown is at the corner of
Broadway and North.
And North Avenue. Mm-hmm. Does this program send a quality of life message of any sort to people or organizations in this community?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it really is part of what makes Normal a great place to live. I mean, you can ask most people what their favorite amenity in our community is, and it's going to be the Constitution Trail for a lot of people. And to give people the opportunity to get on a bike and be on the trail is really fantastic, especially for people who have visitors coming to town. To be able to tell a visitor, you know, I live in Normal, come visit me. Oh, by the way, we have this amazing bike share program and an awesome trail. You know.
Is the fact that the community has a bike share program being used in any way to market the community to potential employers or people considering locating to Bloomington Normal?
We are certainly working with the EDC to have it included in their information. I believe they have information on their website. The CVB has done a ton to help us promote it. It's on their website. Just a couple days ago, there was a big photo shoot for a piece in Travel Illinois, which is a great publication. And so we're definitely getting notice, and I would have to assume that this would help attract people.
I mean, it might not be the reason somebody moves to the community, but it might be a reason.
Exactly. There are very few things other than a job that's the reason.
Sure.
But yeah,
although,
this should be a
reason.
Although
what we know about millennials is they often choose a place to live first and then look for the job.
Absolutely. I mean, speaking of that, the comprehensive plan, when that comes out later this fall, and we talk a lot about quality of life because there's a lot about our community that's really great, and we're never going to be a place with an ocean or a place with a mountain, but we can be a place with an amazing trail and an amazing bike share system.
So what goes into the process to decide whether this program stays where it's at with the current number of kiosks and 47 bikes, or expands, or scales back and ends? What goes into that calculation?
Oh, it's a good question. The town's pretty well committed to this three-year concept. So the system, in theory, could just be maintained at this size and distribution for 3 years. Over this winter, though, Zagster is going to start reaching out to potential sponsors who might want to install new stations to expand the system. The town's not in a position to make this bigger right now. But other partners could come on board, particularly places that have a lot of, like, university students living there, for example. They might want a bike station. In fact, some of them have asked me about it. And so those conversations will be happening over the winter.
So what is your, you know, what do you think will happen? Do you think this, I mean, it'll continue for the 3 years, then what?
Boy, I just see this stuff getting more popular rather than less popular. I mean, money is always going to be the issue. But as far as it being a great idea and being loved, I think that's going to continue and increase over time.
And the sponsorships, does that give the sponsorship, the sponsor, the right to locate the bike share where it's convenient for the sponsor or where it's convenient for the system?
They get to choose because they'd be the one paying for it. So if they want to pay for a station, which would be like 10 spaces and 5 bicycles, and they want to put it like where they have a bunch of residents living, that's great. They'd get their logo on that station sign. They'd get their logo on one panel of the basket there, but it would tie into our program. Like, they're not going to have their own mechanic and their own contract. It's all going to be folded in with us, but certainly they'd get to pick the location. So I've thought of some places that maybe would want a sponsorship just to have their advertising out there, but they really aren't in a good location for a bike station. That would be fantastic.
I mean, an obvious partner is the city of Bloomington. At what point does in Normal have a conversation with someone in Bloomington to say, you know, it's time for you to sort of step up here and maybe also think about subsidizing this and expand this into Bloomington more? Because right now, the two stations that are in Bloomington are paid for by Normal.
Yeah, that is correct. And we're planning to keep with that for this three-year period. To be fair, you know, we did talk to City of Bloomington early on before we made the decisions, and they just weren't in a place where they could make a quick decision. And finding sponsors was just proving to be more complicated than we thought. So we didn't want to make it more complicated by bringing in lots of other big partners. We just wanted to get it started.
So after the third year, you might... leading up to the third year,
absolutely,
you might be talking to Bloomington.
Absolutely. And they expressed interest at the time, even that the idea of it, they liked it. It was all good. They weren't on a timeline that could accommodate our timeline. So.
And any expansion at this point will be sponsorship based.
Definitely. Yeah.
So in March, when we talked, you said the town focused essentially on the Main Street corridor through the community. Is there potential for usage growth by putting kiosks in lower income neighborhoods where maybe people don't have access to 2 or 3 cars?
You know, it's an interesting question. We certainly talked about that to start with and decided to go with stations that just seem the most likely to succeed. And I think we still need to get a few more months worth of data under our belts. The issue is going to be that we're not really in a position to pay to expand the system in the next year or so. And so unless a sponsor came along and wanted to pick a location that correlated with, you know, a lower or more moderate income neighborhood, you know, that could work great. If it doesn't, we're probably looking at a couple more years of status quo from the town end.
What's a sponsorship cost, or is there a scale?
The way I understand it from Zagster, because they would work directly with Zagster, and it's $9,000, and that's, you know, it's an annual thing. And for that, you get a 10-space station and 5 bikes, and then you're advertising all over the place on the app, on the website, everywhere else.
Okay, Mercy Davison is the Town of Normal planner. You're involved in bike policy and programming for the Town of Normal. Thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Well, thank you, Mike. See you at the bike rodeo.
I'll be at the bike rodeo. That's on the 29th. It's an opportunity for kids in Uptown in the Parkinson lot to learn more about bicycle safety. Helmets?
Free helmets. Courtesy of Advocate Foundation and the Friends of the Constitution Trail.
All right. It's an obvious music choice, but is Queen okay?
I love Queen.
All right.
Go for it.
All right. Bicycle song Queen. Thanks, Mercy. It's Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org.
Bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bike.
Chica.
I want to ride it where I...
It's Sound Ideas. The NCAA has once again been rocked by a cheating scandal. Federal prosecutors in New York this week indicted four men's basketball assistant coaches on charges of fraud and corruption. Authorities say agents and financial advisors paid bribes to assistant coaches to get introductions to starting college players and their parents before the students turned professional. In a conversation in his Redbird Arena office, Illinois State University head men's basketball coach Dan Muller told GLT's John Norton that though the scandal is shocking, it's not the cheating per se that surprised him.
The numbers, as far as how much money that's provided, you hear rumors, and so you've heard those numbers. Every time I hear $100,000 or hundreds, I'm like, wow, really? The biggest surprise is that, of course, there's federal indictments. FBI's involved. There's prison time that looks like it's going to be served for cheating and recruiting, which I don't think anybody really thought about those things. It's disappointing. I don't want anybody to go to prison, not that I get a vote.
Assistant coaches were snared in this investigation so far. There may be more. Is it realistic to think that head coaches of programs don't know what's going on if the assistant coaches are taking money?
Yeah, you know what? I honestly believe this. I think it's realistic that there are assistant coaches that can and are cheating that head coaches have no clue and have done everything they can to deter.
Really?
Sure, absolutely. You know, our job, and I do it with my staff, is to make sure we know the rules, which our compliance office obviously helps us with that. And then my job is to have a culture of ethical, high integrity, and talk to the guys, make sure, hey, we're not doing anything like this. Remind them once a month, whatever it is. Recruiting, make sure we're making good decisions. But in the end, it still comes down to them making the decisions. And so it can absolutely happen where you don't know. I think the majority of head coaches where it's happening either know or choose not to know.
Like a wink and a nod?
Well, not even a wink and a nod. Just don't ask. Mm. Not even a, hey, go ahead and get that done. More of a...
He just winked, by the way.
Yeah, I just winked. That's right. But more of a, I don't want to ask how it got done because I don't want to know, and I know if I know, then I will be liable. I don't know. I've never worked for a coach where it's been involved, or so I don't know how it gets done when those things happen in cheating, because it's always so, like I've said to friends, I don't know how you get the money from, where the money come, you know. And so now obviously the shoe companies and financial agents,
sure.
But it's always been a little bit of a mystery how all this stuff gets done.
Because ISU is considered a quote mid-major,
yeah.
Do you probably not have to deal with that as much as, say, a Kentucky, North Carolina, Kansas program?
Yeah, and I don't want to say those programs specifically, but the higher level recruit, the higher ranked recruit,
uh-huh.
The more there's money asked for involved. Not every recruit. I mean, I'm sure there's a number one recruit in the country over the last 5 years that didn't ask for any money and it wasn't paid any money. So it's not every kid. But the chances and the money go up as the player gets better, of course, because they have more potential as a professional.
You did travel in those circles for a little while when you were assistant coach at Vanderbilt. You were under former ISU coach Kevin Stallings. Former coach Richardson, Tom Richardson of ISU, put out a tweet yesterday in no uncertain terms, said if Stallings ever had any clue something like this was going on, he would shut down the recruiting right now.
Yep.
Can you talk about when you were at Vanderbilt and you were traveling a little bit of a higher circle in the recruiting? What were you hearing then compared to what you hear now at ISU or other maybe mid-major schools might?
Here was our deal with Coach Stallings, and I retweeted Coach Richardson's tweet because I do agree with it. And yet it was more of, look, we're not going to get him, so there's no reason to recruit him.
Because he's too high a level recruit?
No, because there's cheating involved.
Okay, you knew that.
Right.
You knew what was going on.
At times you knew.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, because you get asked the same questions, implied the same things, and when you say no, then, you know, somebody else, you know, happens to do it or whatever. It wasn't as much of, you know, we're not going to be involved if there's cheating involved. It was more of, if you get to a certain point, we're not going to get the kid, so we're not going to keep recruiting him.
Why waste your energy?
Yeah, why do we keep trying?
We're in the office of Illinois State University head men's basketball coach Dan Muller. You also had a tweet yesterday, in addition to your retweet of Coach Richardson, in reply to Jay Billis of ESPN, who said every program in the country should be nervous right now. And you're like, no.
Yeah.
And are you saying that because mid-majors probably don't have to sweat, or because there's really only a handful of even the majors that are doing stuff like that?
Yeah, you know, again, I don't like to speculate, so I don't know who does what unless I'm working with you. You hear stories, but, you know, and it wasn't just to Jay Billis. It's most media people when they're talking about this or describing it. And I heard Pat Forty this morning on Mike and Mike, who is as well respected as anybody, and he said very specifically, every head coach in the country is nervous right now, and so most are saying it, and I understand that. But it just makes us all look so bad. It's not true.
To follow up on that, you're not nervous.
No.
You look pretty laid back.
Not nervous, and I hire guys and we talk about it. None whatsoever.
Earlier, you alluded to the conversations you have with your players and probably your coaches and other staff. Could you be a little more specific about that? How often do you have those conversations? And are these the kind of conversations you have about these allegations even that are coming out right now?
Yeah, so it's, I don't know, 5-6 years ago, the NCAA changed how they could legislate and hold accountable head coaches. And basically they say that whatever happens in your program as a head coach, you're responsible for. You cannot continue to play the I didn't know card. The assistant coach gets fired, gets a show cause, but the head coach continues to go scot-free. So it's our responsibility as head coaches. Every head coach knows this. Our compliance office, Cindy Harris, does a terrific job of updating us and reminding us, but we have to have those discussions with our coaches and our players, but more so our coaches. So beginning of every year, a couple times here and there, but we'll have a specific meeting about it. And, hey, guys, I know you know this. When I interview people, I talk about it. I think that's where it starts. Integrity. We're not breaking rules. So just understand what's going to happen when you come here. And then we get together as staff, and I have them sign something and just talk about we're not going to break rules. We're not going to cheat in recruiting. We're not going to cheat with our players, blah, blah, blah. I understand that. You know, it's one of the ways you can get fired. And then other than that, so we get updates. Like every month we'll have recruit compliance meetings in our department. But in the end, you have to trust your coaches because you're not with them on the road recruiting or on the phone or what have you. And I do.
Illinois State University men's head basketball coach Dan Muller, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
GLT's John Norton speaking this morning with ISU head men's basketball coach Dan Muller about the FBI indictments of NCAA men's assistant basketball coaches, agents, and financial advisors. You're listening to Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping individuals and families create solid plans for the future through a combination of investment options and life insurance. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Hi, I'm Frank Boyd, a GLT contributing listener, and I give to GLT because WGLT is a very important part of the Bloomington Normal community. Being a member of a community means something, and I know that WGLT's programming depends on our support. This fund drive is underway, and it's time for you to renew or make a first-time contribution. Click on Donate at WGLT.org.
We're working with you to make this fund drive as painless as possible. Instead of taking 20 minutes out of each hour to ask for your financial support, we're only asking in short breaks like this one. We hope you'll get the message and give what you can to help pay for Sound Ideas and everything you value about GLT. You can do that right now at WGLT.org. It's Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. When the pop rock quintet Red Scarves play the Route 66 Roadhouse in the Twin Cities this weekend, they'll be featuring songs from their yet-to-be-released new album. GLT's John Norton has more about the band and their new album. He's joined via Skype by band member Ryan Donlan, who doubles on bass and guitar for Red Scarves.
The song is titled Penelope. It's from Sorta Scarlet, the album Red Scarves are planning for a late October release. Though now based in Chicago, band member Ryan Donlan says Red Scarves has roots in Bloomington, having formed just over 5 years ago at Illinois Wesleyan University.
Robbie, our drummer, is still in his last year, but we will, fingers crossed, all be Illinois Wesleyan grads next year.
What did you study? What do the other guys study? Are y'all in the music department or in your various degrees that
No,
you're working on?
We're in various degrees. degrees. I studied music, and so did the singer, Braden, and Robbie, the drummer, is studying music also. But Eric, our sax and keys player, was an art major, and our lead guitarist, Athaw, was a psychology major.
Okay. Well, hell, half the Beatles and Stones were all art majors, too, so that worked out pretty well for them.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
We have some precedent.
That right hook.
You were studying at Wesleyan in music. What was it, jazz music or was it classical music? What were you studying at Wesleyan?
It was jazz and classical.
When you go to school for classical and jazz music, do you have pop in the back of your mind a little bit?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when I was learning things in my classical music classes, when it came to like music theory and how music worked, I was definitely thinking about how I could apply them to, you know, songs and stuff.
Is there a way to step us through, us non-music theory guys? How does studying classical and or jazz theory help you write pop music songs?
Well, there's a lot of moving, well, not a lot, but there's like five or six moving parts in a rock band as far as like instruments go. We're all playing different things. And I think studying classical music and just music theory in general helps you have an understanding of how you can get those parts to work together in the best possible way. And like just form convincing, chord changes and melodies and just get everything to flow just right.
When I stared in-
Is it helpful to have a background in classical jazz theory to be able to write good pop songs, or can anybody do it?
I think anyone can do it. I think it's helpful if you want to write a certain kind of pop song. I think it's helped me write the kinds of songs that I want to write, but I definitely don't think it's necessary to be able to write great songs.
Are you the principal songwriter in the band, or do you guys collaborate?
No, I'm not. The guy who's singing most of the songs, Braden Poole, writes most of the songs, and then Athaw, the lead guitarist, writes, I think he wrote three or four for the album, and I wrote one, and the drummer wrote one as well.
Can't seem to hold on.
This is another song from the Sort of Scarlet album by Red Scarves. It's yet another catchy pop number titled Waiting on the Day. And though they're firmly planted in pop music, Ryan Donlan says the band originated from an interest in a different kind of music.
It started as like a folk rock band, kind of that formed from a mutual interest in the music of Bob Dylan with Athaw and Brady and some other people. Jonas Whiteman and Alan Rushen, who aren't in the band anymore. Eventually, they started being interested in different kinds of music, more like rock kind of stuff. And there were some lineup changes, and I joined the band 3 years ago, along with the drummer and sax and keys player, Robbie and Eric. And then we started writing music together. And that eventually became the EP and the album.
Okay. Well, there's five guys in the band. Is it hard to get everybody together on the same page as far as what you want to play and the writing of the songs themselves?
Yeah, it's definitely hard. But we're all pretty open to the ideas of everybody else, and it's a completely open and collaborative process, and if someone has an idea, we'll try it, and if it works, great, and if it doesn't, we're quick to let everybody know.
GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Ryan Donlan from Red Scarves. We're talking about the band's upcoming release, Sorta Scarlet. Make Up Your Mind is another song on the album with an interesting mix of instruments. It opens with a Rickenbacker hollow body guitar played by Braden Poole, followed by Eric Novak on a Rhodes keyboard.
Yeah, it's definitely the fastest one on the album. The only one like in a minor key, so it sounds a little more menacing. and the other songs on the album. It's a lot of our mom's favorite song
okay.
that we've written. We all wrote our respective parts for it. It was a collaborative process, as most of our songs are.
The band itself, the Red Scarves, certainly has a huge 1960s influence. I hear that. To hear someone your age that, is really into 1960s music and even kind of sounds that way now, I think it's a really interesting how things are going backwards, where people today, whether it's the rock of maybe even like the heavier rock, like Cream and Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix, to, you guys are going back to more Beatles stuff and more of the pop stuff. I think it's really interesting how the younger people are going back to the 1960s and maybe 1970s to play new music today.
Yeah, I think that is definitely true and interesting. And I think in music, there have been like waves of like complication and simplification, where like bands will like, have more complicated chord progressions and melodies and structures and stuff. And then a group of bands will come, or like a general cultural shift will happen where things will simplify. Like, punk was simplification. And I think that now people are looking back to the 60s because that was like a complication. People were writing more complicated jazz inspired kind of songs. And I think that our songwriting style is like just a throwback to that jazz-tinged pop world, because we're all really into those jazz chords and stuff.
Ah, okay. All right. Well, you're playing the Roadhouse in Bloomington. Where's the Roadhouse?
I was actually told by the owner of the house not to give the exact location, but you can definitely look on Facebook for the event and see the bands that are playing, and if you reach out to the bands, we can give you the exact location.
So it's another house show, basically.
Yeah.
Ah, got it. Okay. Brian Donlan of the Red Scarves, congratulations on the upcoming album. I know a lot of folks looking forward to seeing you in Bloomington this weekend. Thank you for your time, and nice job on a new album. This sounds great.
Thanks a lot, and thanks for talking with me.
Red Scarves play a house show at the Route 66 Roadhouse in the Twin Cities Saturday night. Check the Roadhouse events page on Facebook for details and venue location. Preview songs from Red Scarves on Spotify. Discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. And thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media.